This afternoon, Omar Hassan, who's a member of the Sydney branch of Socialist Alternative, will be introducing our a vital discussion about how revolutionaries build in the here and now, but drawing from history. He'll speak for about half an hour or so, and then we'll throw the floor open for your questions and comments. So just hold fire until then, but do store up some things that you might want to contribute for our final discussion of the conference. So without further ado, I'll ask Omar to introduce our discussion.
So this is the final session of the conference, which is really sad for all of us, because after today there's a formal all-in, whatever, but this is the final workshop of the conference. And that's really sad, because we're about to go back to our reality, which is not filled with hundreds of people discussing revolutionary politics on an hourly basis, meeting dozens of new people everywhere. But it is extremely important that we do go back and we apply the lessons we've learnt at this conference to try and build a left and change the world. And this is really a talk about the nuts and bolts of doing just that. Hopefully, many people in this audience have either just decided to join Socialist Alternative or have joined recently or are thinking about doing so in the near future. This talk is really aimed at you. It's a talk designed to give you the tools and concepts you need to make sense of what our organisation is all about, what we're trying to do, and how you, as an individual and then as part of a collective, can contribute to playing an active and engaged role in doing that project with us. So the three key arguments I want to make, I guess. The first is that a mass workers' party is absolutely crucial if we're ever to see a successful workers' revolution. Second, that helping to build a socialist organisation today is a vital step in the project of one day contributing to the construction of that kind of organisation. And three, that being part of a revolutionary socialist organisation today is also the best way of contributing to improving the lives of workers and the oppressed all around the world and here in Australia right now as well. Okay, so to start with, the main goal of any and the main task of any revolutionary is to make a revolution. That's just the basic principle of revolutionary politics. And that seems kind of obvious, but the goal of revolutionary transformation of society is not just a goal that's over there. It shapes so much of what we do as an organisation. And so, for us, what is a revolution? A revolution is a grassroots, mass, spontaneous explosion of creativity and energy from the majority of the population. And in the best case scenarios of revolutions, workers begin to take power into their own hands. Revolutions are joyful and chaotic and messy processes, where lots of different demands from lots of different sections of the population burst to the foremost. And millions of people are involved in what Lenin called a festival of the oppressed. Now, revolutions themselves, however, are not the solutions to society's problems. They only begin to pose possible solutions. Revolutions can actually, and have actually, ended in defeat many a time. For revolutions to succeed, for the problems of capitalism to be resolved, it requires the construction of a democratic decision-making process, an institution of governance that can cover the whole of society. It requires a kind of leadership that can think tactically, flexibly, move quite quickly in various situations during the revolution. It requires an organisation that can, in all different spaces of society, argue convincingly for radical politics and against the arguments of moderates. And it needs an organisation with a logistical capacity to carry that out, not just in one part of the country, in one city, one university, one major workplace, but everywhere, because these debates will happen everywhere. Now, there's no way that all of these factors can come together spontaneously in a revolutionary process. You can get one or two of them. Many revolutions have created the kind of workers' councils that we talk a lot about in Socialist Alternative quite spontaneously, but revolutions cannot create organisation, leadership, network, structure, all at a timely and rapid rate in order to succeed. Because in revolution, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, it's not as simple as there is a line of people who support the revolution and a line of people that oppose it. It's not like a footy match where you have the great and glorious Collingwood Football Club on one side fighting for workers' rights and like Carlton or something on the other fighting for the capitalists. It's not that simple. And actually, it's been parties who say they support revolutions who've historically been the most successful at destroying them. And hopefully, people have been to some of the sessions about May 68 in France, about the German Revolution, and many others, to hopefully have learned that lesson. So we need a mass party to try and combat alternative, more moderate leaderships and to lead things in a successful direction. By mass party, it's important to understand what we're talking about, because in this situation, the left is relatively shriveled. A mass party is an organization of 100, 200, 300,000 people. That's what a mass party looks like. Basically because size is influence. You can't have influence on society if you're too small. That's just the reality of revolutionary processes. But you don't just need to have accumulated random numbers of people. You need people who know how to lead others, how to inspire others to get involved in activism. People who can be told, can you please go to this organizing meeting, convince people to have a protest, can you get up and make a speech on the blink of an eye, all this kind of stuff. That all takes time and experience. And it's not just about a mass organization with experienced people. It's also about a collective team of people. It's about people who know how to work together, who trust each other, who have experience in debating and disagreeing with each other, but not falling apart into splits or factional kind of cliquishness. And that's something that takes time and energy to build up. Now, I don't have time to talk about more about what kind of organization is required in detail at a mass level, but there are substantial articles in the Marxist Left Review, which I would encourage you to read on this question, as well as any decent book about the Russian Revolution. So we'd all love to see this kind of organization exist, a mass revolutionary party in Australia and in every country on the planet. How do we get there? The first point to understand is that to some extent it's out of our hands. The basic conditions for a mass political revolutionary party is a mass politicization and crisis in society. And this is kind of obvious when you think about it. If very few people are questioning society, then very few people are going to be interested in revolutionary politics. It's like setting up an ice cream stand in the middle of winter. You'll find some hardy people who want that Golden Gate time, but for a lot of people, they're going to be waiting to summer before they go by your stall. All right. And so if we're honest to ourselves, we'll realise that Australia is something like that situation right now. There are plenty of people who are against the system. There are plenty of people, specific injustices. There are heaps of those people. And there are plenty of people who think the system is wrong. But that's a different question to the number of people who think it's worth politically organising and committing to changing the world in an ongoing and consistent way. And you can contrast that to the scenes of rebellion and protest that people have been seeing on the revolutionary cinema at this conference, and also just throughout history, some of the lessons we've talked about. And they're not the only times, May 68, German Revolution, that this obviously happens. It happens every generation, multiple times in some cases, where people want to challenge the world in a mass sense. Most recently, we've seen mass movements in Latin America, Egyptian and Arab Spring more broadly. We've seen the Occupy movement, we've seen the Indignados. These things happen, and they happen regularly. And at those times, at those moments in history, the people who have dismissed the radical left, who would walk past you trying to sell your newspaper and kind of look their nose down at you or whatever, those people suddenly are thirsty for radical ideas. They want to know how to change the world. They're thinking about it themselves. And all those radical politics that the left has been putting forward for ages suddenly seem to make sense. So the questions that they're asking, we have the answers to. Now, in those situations, though the majority of people are getting political for the first time, and you can see those explosions happen, and we've talked about them, the people who tend to be influential are not in the same category. In no situation, really, are the leaders of these new movements totally, totally new to politics. In fact, they often tend to be drawn from existing milieus, organisations, or personalities from the radical left. And there's a bunch of examples. You know, the Black Panther Party is very famous, but many of its leading members had been active for almost a decade in the civil rights movement prior to that. The student leaders in 68 came from various splits and dissidents from the communist movement. The Bolsheviks who led the Russian Revolution had been organising for decades prior to that, some as early as the 1890s. And you can go on. And this makes sense for a few reasons. Partly because you can't just step on the scene and expect people to listen to you and have much credibility. Things don't really work that way. Secondly, nobody is born with the skills and the charisma and the arguments and the experience to command a crowd and to convince people to take certain actions. You only get that from years of activism, of collaboration, of working alongside others, of fucking things up, of getting things right, discussing it, reflecting on it, kind of generalizing the lessons, and so on. And so when people engage in activism for the first time, it's almost always existing political leaderships and activists who they look to for guidance and leadership. Now, the reason this matters is the political characteristics of those people who are, you know, pre-existing becomes very important in determining the shape of these radicalizations and movements. Through their pre-existence, they create a certain common sense on the left, a certain kind of basic understanding of what it means to be left-wing, of what it means to be anti-capitalist or not, in that, if they're not, and that kind of diffuses through the movement in a much more broad way. And so, for example, in the 1960s, the majority of people who were politicized at that moment were convinced of versions of Stalinism. This was the case globally, as some of us have been to some sessions about, but even here in Australia, the Maoists were very large in Melbourne, also in parts of Adelaide. Interestingly, though, Trotskyism was bigger in Sydney. And there's an explanation for that. It's because the different political organizations that existed in different cities shaped the politics. And so incredibly small numbers of people, really. It was like 3 or 4 people in Sydney, really, who were coherent Trotskyists at the beginning of the radicalization, who were then able to set up organizations like called Resistance and so on, which were able to inspire and lead a number of people. But everywhere else, really, it was Stalinism that dominated. And so precisely because of Stalinism, the system was able to stabilize itself and the opportunities of that moment were lost. Now, today, I don't think it's going to be Stalinism so much that is a determining political feature of a new generation of radicals, but clearly reformism, the idea you can change the world within the system, is still, you know, overwhelming. You know, you look at Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn. These are very good developments, but very much within the reforming framework. So it's important to understand with that even the most well-meaning reformists, if they don't understand the limitations of that strategy, can lead to just as much destruction as the most cynical authoritarian Stalinist. And we can only see what happened in Chile in 1972-73 and the kind of military coup following from years of reformism and conciliation to see that. So those of us with revolutionary politics have an influence to organize, to prepare ourselves and our organizations to hopefully contest for leadership of these future movements and these future radicalizations. It doesn't feel like it right now, but people with clear and organized and coherent politics can have a massive impact on things when things get good. Now, there are other times, short of a full-scale radicalization, that the formation of a mass socialist organization, you can take a big step in that direction. And that is when you see the development of kind of new left or broad left or kind of radical left organizations, as we've seen in Spain, if people went to the Comrade from Spain's talks, in Greece a few years earlier, and to a sort of different way, but in a similar way, in Jeremy Corbyn in Britain. Now, at moments like these and in organizations like these, while they don't substitute for a mass revolutionary party, by politicizing and organizing a whole layer of radical people and giving that coherence and shape and structure, that can be a massive step in the construction of a radical left or revolutionary left party going forward. And it's easy to see why many people are attracted to these organizations. They seem to be both a radical break with the status quo and the parties of neoliberalism, but also, you know, still working within the framework of common sense. So elect Corbyn, change the world. That's obviously much more palatable than fight, 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 overthrow capitalism one day, and then you'll achieve a better world. So that is just the reality of consciousness. However, we know from history that revolutionary parties have always been built by people who think that one day, realizing that that itself cannot actually fulfill their desires. That left reformism, radical reformism, comes up against limits, and when those limits are exposed to people, large chunks of people can radicalize to the left and decide that a more revolutionary road is necessary. And the pre-existence of a radical left within or alongside those kind of organizations, and which one you do is a very tactical thing, but being alongside or within such a movement and relating to it in a constructive but politically principled way can lead to substantial strengthening of the left wing of those movements, in the short term. And then in the medium term, if those movements come up against the limits of reformism, putting yourself in a position to recruit not just individuals who have concluded that it was a waste of time, but chunks of people, thousands of people, depending on the size of the organisation, can be won to revolutionary politics at times like that. But to be a pole of attraction in those situations of the new left parties, to be a relevant factor in the unfolding processes of how that party relates to capitalism and the system and parliamentary processes and so on, you need to be sizable. You need to have enough people to be taken seriously. You can't have a few expert commentators on the side trying to offer advice. You need to have enough organising capacity so that you are a general pole of attraction. Okay, so to summarise this section of the presentation, we can't fast-track the growth of a mass revolutionary party outside of the conditions we find ourselves in. So we need to be somewhat patient on that front. At the same time, we know that politicisation and radicalisation will come, and in fact, really, we're seeing it at a global level. It's happening. It's not coming. It's already happening. And so we must be constantly trying to prepare ourselves for that process. And the way we intervene can vary depending on exactly how things unfold. But the more numbers we have, the more we can intervene in a proactive and constructive way. And there's a sort of negative example of this, unfortunately, and that is the Egyptian Revolution itself, which for some of you will be something you remember from when you were a child. But for some of us, it was a really formative moment where you see from 2011 to 2013, millions and tens of millions of people protesting on the streets for months at a time. Incredible heroism, fighting back with the police, pushing them off the streets, confronting violent thugs on camels, whipping people, murdering people, women getting sexually harassed and saying no, by the police I should say, and saying no, I'm going to come back, I don't give a shit what you do. But you imagine yourself in a square filled with 10 million people, and you're an organisation like our comrades were in Greece of less than 100, and you might as well not be there, is a sad reality. You can't impact it. How could you possibly influence a crowd of 10 million people with an organisation of less than 100? It's just not possible. And so the tragedy is, you can be part of the groups that call these revolutions, that organise these movements, but if you don't have the numbers, then the movements can sweep through you, and much larger political organisations with very cynical approaches can take over and lead it to utter ruin. And so we need to prepare for these kind of moments, whether they're full-on revolutions, whether they're political movements that inspire millions and then drop away, whether they're the development of new left parties, whatever it might be. The more of us there are, the more we can achieve. And it's worth saying that within our context, we've been able to take small steps to preparing in that way. In the last 5 or 6 years or so, we've gone from about 200 to about 400 members, which is it's not earth-shattering, it's not world-changing, but it's something very substantial in the context of Australia, where the left is disintegrating, and probably the combined forces of the socialist left outside of us would number less than 100. Okay, so that's the main argument to be a socialist, to be honest, today, and that's the main argument about how we can build going forward. And if we're totally blunt, that's what it's all about. But for those of you in this room, that can feel a bit distant, right? I mean, the internet generation, it's all about instant gratification. You want results now. You can't read books. You read short articles. You read Twitter, whatever. So there is also a kind of immediate argument to be in the revolutionary left. And that is that being an active revolutionary today is the best way to have an impact on politics right now. It's the best way to make change right now. And that can seem a bit of a counterintuitive argument, that being for the total abolition of capitalism means that you're more able to achieve practical results within capitalism. But it's absolutely true. And there's many, many examples of that. I'll go through a couple of them very briefly. The attacks on education in this country have been coming through thick and fast for years. We as an organisation have made it a priority to combat that and to try and rebuild student unionism and radical politics on the campuses. A few years ago, in 2014, the government tried to totally deregulate university fees, which would have meant an American-style system. No limits. Universities could arbitrarily decide how much to charge people. Some research showed that some degrees would go up to over $100,000. Through determined organising and protesting and occupations and so on, we were able to stop that, not just once, not just twice, but three times. And education remains a central issue in Australian politics. Around the country, a few years ago, when the far right reared their ugly head and began organising the Reclaim Australia marches, which were really not about reclaiming anything, but about asserting a racist, you know, quasi-fascistic nationalist message of exclusion of Muslims and minorities and so on. We jumped into action. We were the only organization capable of organizing a national movement against the fascists. And we did that. And we launched into it. And in most cities now, the fascists are basically invisible. In refugee rights, in the campaign to stop Adani, in trade union work, our members have won numerous awards for their activism, best delegate of the year. They've organized some wildcat strikes and so on. People who are not working class currently, but who are students, have gone down to pickets. And if you like any one of our Facebook pages of our student clubs, you will see that we regularly take down dozens of people to picket lines all across the country, both to win those students to the idea of working class politics, but also to try and convince the workers of those picket lines that socialists have something to say to them and can offer them some sort of political analysis of what to do and where the world is at. And I want to talk about marriage equality in a second, because that's our most triumphant achievement. But I'll leave that for now. The most important thing that we contribute to these movements is not just that we turn up to the protest, because I think when you're new to politics, that's kind of what you think being an activist means, that you turn up to protest. That's important, but it's not the main thing we offer. Nor is it simply organizing and promoting those protests. That's also very important, to help put up posters, to talk to students, to argue with them, argue with workers. Don't just, you know, work an extra shift. Don't just stay at home with your family. Come to this protest. It's very important. Here's why. We do all that, but the most important thing we do is to actually bring a political perspective to the table in these kind of campaigns of mass action, of involving as many people as possible in defiance of the authorities. And that's really important, because every time a campaign emerges, and that can be a small campaign like, trying to save some cuts at Monash University, for example, trying to stop that from happening, or it can be a, you know, May 68 style movement. Doesn't matter to what scale you're talking about, there will always be debates and disagreements in those campaigns. So there will always be people who think we should write polite letters to MPs. There will always be people who think we should limit our tactics and strategies to keep the media on side. There will always be people who think that we should subordinate activism to electoral success, and that when there's an election coming around, we've got to stop all this protesting stuff and bring it back to getting the vote out. Now, these arguments come from a range of places. Some people are well-meaning but naive. Others are very cynical Labour Party or Green Party hacks. But whoever is saying it, that if implemented, if we follow these arguments, then we see disaster in our movements. Socialists have a very different approach. Instead of asking nicely for change, we demand it, because we understand that those who run our society are not interested in rational dialogue. They don't do what they do out of ignorance or confusion or lack of understanding of the issues. They know very well the refugees are dying on Manus Island and Nauru. In fact, they understand very well that their survival as a class and as a government or whatever is premised on the immiseration and exploitation of the majority. We don't kowtow to the corporate media who present neo-Nazis on mainstream television on a regular basis, but present peaceful protesters or activists as thugs. Instead, we mobilize our power that we know that we have in the workplace, where possible, through our unions, where possible, but on the street and the campuses, where that's possible as well. And we're militant about it, because not only is it extremely fun to defy the authorities and do exactly what they're telling us not to do, but it's also been proven by history that defying authorities is the way to get things done. The more our rulers fear us, the more they think they're going to be challenged, potentially overthrown, the more they offer us to try and buy us off. That is a lesson of history. And so it's important to understand, however, that these arguments, this common sense, in my opinion, is not always just accepted by the left and by the broader movements that we're a part of. It's not. In fact, when moderates argue for kind of conciliation, for obeying the police, for doing what's right, going through the channels, writing polite letters, filling in those stupid postcards that they sometimes get you to do, they're going with the flow of capitalist common sense. Because the capitalist system makes us feel powerless. They make us feel like we can't do anything, like there's a proper channel. So they actually have a massive advantage over us, because we're arguing to rupture for the status quo, and they're arguing merely to go with it. So again, in our movements, we need to be organized right now to try and combat these politics. Because these strategic debates have real consequences. I want to talk about 2017. I think it was a very important year in two ways. The first is the issue of penalty rates, which were totally destroyed by the Liberal government without a whimper. And the second is the enormously successful campaign for marriage equality, which had a massive victory last year. Now, the contrast between the two campaigns couldn't be starker. On one hand, the penalty rates issue affects workers and unions. Unions have a paid apparatus of probably, tens of thousands of full-time people, people who are paid to organise workers and the union movement. Tens of thousands of people. They have an activist base in the form of union members of, I think it's over a million people who are members of unions in Australia, probably much more than that. Plus, the cuts to penalty rates was overwhelmingly opposed by the Australian population. I think it was 70% of people opposed it. More people opposed the cuts to penalty rates than supported marriage equality, actually. And yet, there was not a single protest last year of any size against the penalty rate cuts. What there was a handful of memes on Facebook organised by the Australian Council of Trade Unions. Again, an organisation of probably thousands of full-time officials who spend all their time sitting in offices, getting paid much more than the average wage of working-class people. They organised some memes. They've organised a video now on TV to change the rules. And that's about it. In contrast, the marriage equality campaign last year had a small apparatus. In Sydney, I think primarily, there was a handful of gay millionaires who spent quite a lot of money on television ads, which were quite conservative. But basically, that was like in a vacuum. Those people were pretty irrelevant. On the ground, in most cities apart from Victoria, it was basically the work of a handful of volunteers, people who were not paid, who were doing it in their part-time, after work, after study, after all the things they have to manage. And yet, the same-sex marriage movement, or the marriage equality movement, was able to mobilise tens of thousands of people. In Sydney, where the thing was operated out of a shoestring, led overwhelmingly by us, we organised 50,000 people to support marriage equality in September. And I know that there were thousands of people around the country, tens of thousands here in Melbourne, and so on. Now, this stark contrast of the marriage equality movement and the penalty rates movement is almost entirely due to the different political strategies of the leaders of those movements. The unions could easily have mobilised more than 50,000 people, easily, without even, with putting in minimal effort, they could have done that. But they chose not to. Why? Because their whole approach is to wait for Labor, to vote for Labor and get it done. We decide to mobilise the mass of people, even when there's a Liberal government, and the history books will show we won marriage equality, not under Labor, not even, not a Labor-Greens coalition, but under the Liberal Party. And that's when we want marriage equality. Okay, so to sum up, we absolutely need a mass socialist party in Australia today, in every country for that matter. But the key factor in making that possible is to some extent out of our control. But there are always things that people like us can do to take steps forward in this context. There's always things that we can do to prepare ourselves. And that happens at all different levels. It can be just learning how to make the argument that capitalism cannot be reformed. Learning how to make that argument convincingly is probably the most important skill you can have in this context. Learning how to deal with the regularly heard disagreements with socialist politics. Learning how to inspire a classmate or a friend to come to a protest or come to a union meeting or come to a political meeting. Learning how to participate in movements alongside others, learning how to negotiate with politically antagonistic organisations, how to find consensus or at least a majority agreement for a particular approach to a social movement. And of course, the most important thing is not just that we learn how to do that, not just all of us learn how to do that, but that the number of people who know how to do that is constantly growing. Because all of us, as great as we all are, I'm sure, are not enough to change the political tide in Australia. As we've seen in Britain with Jeremy Corbyn, a kind of new left movement can jump into hundreds of thousands of people extremely quickly. And what can seem right now, like we're the only left activists in town on our campuses, can very quickly flip into much larger organisations with unfortunate politics coming to dominate. So nobody who has attended this conference would fail to understand, I hope, that the world is becoming more and more politicized. Here in Australia, again, like I said, that feeling, you know that it's different, right? It's clearly not the same as everywhere else. But we know from studying the 60s, from studying the previous generations of radicalism, that these things spread in waves, as Jerome has said multiple times at this conference. The same political issues that face people in other countries will face us going forward. The same dynamics everywhere of people grappling with how to change the world and experimentation with radical ideas. It never starts with revolutionary Marxism. That's never going to be the first port of call for newly radicalizing people. They're going to start with something else. But the more that we are prepared to take a stand against that, the more that we can make the most of these opportunities that are coming. What does that look like for us right here? That means tomorrow, having a day off. I presume it's a holiday for most people on your campuses and workplaces. It's a public holiday. Have a day off. Maybe have a few days off. But commit yourself to coming to a political event next week. Don't wait a month. Don't think about it. Don't go home and reflect and whatever. Do all that, but do it on the basis of commitment to ongoing participation. Because capitalism wants us to be passive. Capitalism wants us to accept the status quo, or at least to go along with it 99%. We need to be the people who buck the trend and fight the system right now, always thinking about the future need for a revolutionary organization which can get rid of the system once and for all.